I'm afraid we've kind of trained people to expect you come to church to be better adjusted. Why am I at church? Well, I have a lot of pressures in my daily life. I come to church to have a sense of peace. No, you come to church to be maladjusted. You come to church to say, wow, I've never thought about it that way before.
This is Four People with Bishop Rob Wright.
Hello, everyone. This is Bishop Rob Wright, and welcome to our podcast, Four People. Today, we have a special guest, someone I've long admired, Bishop Will Willimon, Professor Will Willimon. Will Willimon is among the most influential preachers in America. So says one of our great surveys across the church and across the nation. He is a son of South Carolina. He's married to Pat for more than 50 years. He's the father of two. He has a relatively new memoir called The Accidental Preacher, which was released to wide acclaim. He's educated at Wofford, at Yale, and at Emory. Will, welcome.
Thank you, Rob. It's just wonderful to be with you.
We're so glad to have you back in the Diocese of Atlanta, if only virtually. But I tell you why I wanted to talk to you. I was recently rereading a book that you wrote, co-authored with Stanley Hauerwas, called Resident Aliens. And a wonderful book, and I don't know exactly why among the stacks of my books it called out to me, but it's been a great joy to reread it and to hear you expound on what it means to be church. You used the phrase colony of heaven. I'm guessing you're thinking of Philippians there. And so Yes. Can you just say a little bit about what you think over this long, wonderful tenure of ministry, what you think the church actually is? What is the church as far as you understand?
Well, that strikes me, Rob, as a very Episcopal question, because in my experience, Episcopalians are the Protestants who worry about the church and think about the church, love the church. I guess going back, I've been about 10 years into ministry. Stanley Hauerwas and I arrived at Duke about the same time. We started talking, and we realized that during our ministry, years of ministry, that something had changed, something major. Various ways of characterizing that as exile, or as we said in the book, we're beginning, mainline Christians are surprised to find ourselves in North America, feeling like missionaries in the very culture we thought we owned.
Right.
We have a majority consciousness, the notion that America is basically kind of a Christian country and that the church is here in an ancillary position to kind of help America work better. We realized that an attitude that our children would grow up Christian just by breathing the air, drinking the water. Well, we realized that fewer people were believing that assumption today, and there was a new sense that of the importance of the church as a peculiar institution, as different, as countercultural, as something that is not synonymous with the world. I think the resident aliens mentality says, hey, North American Christians, being Christian is just not synonymous with being a thinking, caring, sensitive American. Being Christian is to be someone who is accountable to a very different account of what's going on in the world, who's in charge, where we're headed. And that was, therefore, as we said in Resident Aliens, you don't really need the church if church is synonymous with being an American, with if the kingdom of God and America are the same. However, if you think we are strangers in a strange land, if you think we are a kind of remnant minority, then suddenly church becomes very important as the place where you gather regularly to reiterate this peculiar account that has convened us, namely the gospel.
Right. No, I mean, I the reason why I wanted to get together with you is because I think that according to the news that I read, and I read on the red and I read on the blue, just because we have to read to know what lots of us think, this idea is not the dominant idea. The dominant idea seems to be that that the church is here to help America be better and to try to persuade America to incorporate to some degree what it means to be Christian. And the book seems to suggest something different altogether. The book seems to suggest that we are here. We are called together as a church, strangers thrown together by a God who does extraordinary things to make of us something that bears witness to the world, that says that we're different and we're okay being different, and that we ought to, and that in being different, we are persuading people by our witness that this difference that we're trying to bear witness to is actually the truth. Have I got that right?
Yeah, well said. I think we sometimes have characterized it, our point of view as, hey, church, say something political. Hey, church, say something helpful to the nation. And we say, church, the first duty of the church is to be the church, to be something the world is not, to witness to an account of reality that is different than one that the world lives by. I know my wife and I, Patsy and I, have been worshiping at with the National Cathedral online and have been very grateful for their witness during this time. I notice most of the sermons seem to start with a biblical text, but they get around to saying, you know, let's talk about racism, or let's talk about the climate crisis, or et cetera. And kind of the sermon becomes kind of a plea. Hey, America, you got to do better, and you can do better. And here's how you can do better. That's maybe okay, but it belies a kind of sense that, hey, the church is this strong, vibrant institution, and therefore we need to reach out and kind of help the world run a bit more smoothly. Rather than, I think our time would be better spent to say, hey, church, let's be a community. Let's show the world that Jesus Christ makes possible to be a people of truth, not a people who live by lies, to be a people who are truly affirming of the rich diversity God has given us, to be a light to the nations, rather than simply a kind of mirror of what's already going on. And I think that's important because it says that the work that you do in the church and for the church as a priest, as a layperson, that becomes social witness itself, to say, here's a community, here's a gathering of people that lives by very different standards than are operative in the world, and that can show the world what Jesus Christ makes possible. I know a while back there was an article by Craig Barnes, president of Princeton Seminary, in the Christian Century, and he was sort of saying, hey, if America is divided, if there are controversial, deep divides among us, if there are fierce arguments to be had, that one could say the most appropriate place for such argumentation and recognition of our divisions is the church. What a gift it is to be able to say, hello, I'm Will, I'm a sinner, And that means that what I say to you will be tainted, possibly by my sin. But in order to know that, I'm going to need you to kind of help me see that. Now, let's have an argument about some controversial issue. And let's be as truthful as we can. And let's be as fierce as we can in defending our point of view. Let's also be willing to be open to being modified and changed in that. And then after we have that argument, let's go to the Lord's table and share the body and blood of Christ.
That's right.
What a gift that is. That's not operative in the U.S. Senate. They can't have that kind of argument. Well, right. We can in the church.
This is Four People producer Easton Davis, thanking you for listening to Four People. Four People is a space of digital evangelism dedicated to sharing the good news and leadership of Jesus Christ. Who do you know that needs to hear today's episode? Who do you want to hear it? Subscribe to Four People and keep up with us on Instagram and Facebook at Bishop Rob Wright. And now back to Four People.
You are convinced that God coming into the world in the person of Jesus Christ has created a major difference in everything. It's an intervention, and that we're living downstream of that intervention and ought to live like that intervention was an actual intervention. The church's uniqueness really is not its ability to feed or clothe as other people do, even though those are all wonderful responses to God's intervention, but that our uniqueness is in, again, strangers becoming, acknowledging the fact that they're already family in God's eyes, and that we're living that way over and against a world that doesn't live that way.
Well said. The church knows one thing that the world has yet to know, and that is there has been an intervention, using your words. That intervention has a name and a face, Jesus Christ. Well, we know that. God has turned toward us. We who could not climb up to God, God has climbed down to us. It's called Advent. It's called Christmas. And what a message. But also, we're to live in light of that. The world is quite right in saying, you say there's been an intervention. Well, we can't see any evidence of it.
There you go.
The church is called to be that evidence. I know I was in an Episcopal church in Texas, and I think it was about the time that we were launching the war in Iraq, to end all wars in Iraq, one of the many. Right. And the priest came out and just simply said to the congregation midway through the service, and now we come to the offering, and I want to remind you that our church is attempting to be helpful after the earthquake in Afghanistan, and our goal, we need to raise $10,000 this Sunday. Please consider your giving carefully, et cetera. Well, I told the congregation, I wanted to stand up and say, hey, folks, this ain't happening all over town. That a group of people would get together and say, you have a divine responsibility laid on you by who God is to take responsibility for people you don't even know, people who are not in your family. That is so different. That is un-American, to be concerned about somebody else's children, to be asked to, we don't want you to feel something, we want you to give something, put some money on the table. That's kind of amazing. And I love it when the church, I was in another Episcopal church, and they—
we're going to make an Episcopalian out of you yet.
You need to have me in Atlanta to roam around Episcopal churches saying, thank God you're Episcopalian. I can show you why that can be wonderful. I came out of an Episcopal church some time ago, and a woman said to me, I used to be a Methodist, but now my husband and I, we're now Episcopalians. I said, well, don't brag about it. There are millions like you. You're nobody special that used to be a Methodist. I don't want to hear about it. But anyway, and in the baptism, a family who had come from Nicaragua about a year ago came forth, and the children were baptized. And the priest said to the woman, would you like to say something? And she said in Spanish, and the priest interpreted, we'd never heard of Episcopalians before we came to America. And people in this church were the only people who wanted us here. And they helped us get a job, and they helped us get a car, and they helped us. Well, I thought, how wonderful for the church to say, here's our response to the problem of undocumented people or the problem of immigration, baptism. We adopt people. We take responsibility. Well, to me, that's the wonder that is the church in North America in this moment.
Well, I think what I want to say about that wonderful example is that's what comes through in the book, you don't say this necessarily in the book, you or Stanley Hauerwas, but we've lacked real ecclesiastical imagination, theological imagination in responding to problems. We've responded to problems as the church from a menu that's been given to us by the world, rather than giving the world an imaginative response to what we call the problems. The best example I can give you of that was many years ago, a guy walked into a Quaker community and shot up the school and killed all kinds of kids. And America's heart sort of bled for that. It was all over the news. And oh my God, the gentleman who was not a Quaker walked into the Quaker school and had murdered all these children. And, in the inevitable sort of conversation about guns ensued, et cetera. And then the money began to pour into that Quaker community. And here's what the Quakers did. The Quakers divided up the money. They kept half and gave half to the family of the man who murdered their children because they said that family had also lost a child because the gentleman who had committed the murder had also been killed. And I thought to myself, now there's an enigmatic, imaginative community called the church response that item would not be on the menu of responses in our sort of vengeance sort of mindset, which dominates the world. So there's also another example of how we can be different. Now they didn't lobby Congress. They didn't put any legislation forward. You know, there was no GoFundMe or anything. They just, in that simple and sublime act, they knocked the building down and they gave half the money away. And I will never forget, that example of what it might mean to respond to the world's, quote, problems as a church. We had Sister Helen Prejean on the podcast not long ago, and she talked about how she had gotten to 40 years of life before she realized, and she'd been in the church all her life, and she was in the suburbs of New Orleans just doing the church stuff, you know. And it was until 40 years of her journey with Jesus that it hit her like a ton of bricks that she ought to live different. Now, you've been a man of letters and a man of words and an author and scholar and all that. I wonder when this sort of radical upside down view of things hit you like a ton of bricks, or was it gradual, or did it just knock on the door and welcome itself into your life?
I think probably gradual. People sometimes ask after Resident Aliens appeared, what were your models? For Stanley, has been very influenced by the Mennonites, the Anabaptist tradition, and their witness. I think for me, growing up in South Carolina, it was the Black church. I first really encountered the Black church as a college student during the civil rights days. And it was a people that gathered to try to protect their children, to try to They maybe didn't say a lot about it, or they didn't put it that way, but I know as a college student, I asked an African-American minister, you know, I like the service, but how come it takes an hour and 45 minutes? And he laughed, as you just laughed, and he said, young adult unemployment, male unemployment, is running at about 40% in this neighborhood. That means that when my people get out of here and back on the street, everything they see tells them, you're nothing. You're nobody. So I got to get them here in the church and say, that's a lie. You are royalty. You have been bought with a price. God is going to get what God wants through you. So, and it takes me about an hour and 45 minutes to get the head straight. Well, it was just wonderful. And then he said to me, how long are you accustomed to worshiping in your neighborhood?
Yeah.
Well, it was a wonderful point to make. Who needs worship? Who needs to spend time plowing through the Book of Common Prayer if being a Christian is synonymous with being a nice person? No, being Christian is synonymous with, it's relatable to a story. Or as a woman told me when she said she enjoyed being an Episcopalian, and I said, why would you enjoy that? Or she said, I've just found it helpful. And I said, have you found it helpful? And she said to me, you think I'm going to pray for my enemies left to my own devices? The only way, she said, has anybody ever been on the face of the earth who naturally prayed for their enemies and blessed those who persecute them? Said, the only way I can do that is to be forced to do that by the Book of Common Prayer. And I said, the bishop ought to send you on the road to give that speech all over. Thank God your church loves you enough to say, we're going to help you live the life that the intervention of Jesus Christ necessitates.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, you know, this conversation reminds me of a little phraseology Dr. King used to use. He used to talk about being maladjusted to the world. And if you're going to be adjusted to God as much as we can be adjusted to God and adjusted to following Jesus Christ in the world, you're going to be out of step with the world. You're going to be maladjusted. Say a word or two about how we can help ourselves. I know God is helping us through the sustaining power of the Holy Spirit and also the Spirit running through fellowship, witnesses one to the other. But say a word about, in your experience, what it takes to live in that tension of being maladjusted and being somehow all right with that.
Well, you know, I think it's fascinating that I'm afraid we've kind of trained people to expect you come to church to be better adjusted. Why am I at church? Well, I have a lot of pressures in my daily life. I have a lot of stress. I have a lot of anxieties. I come to church to have a sense of peace. Or, hey, you need to adjust to who you are. You need to be comfortable in your own skin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, generally, people on top, affluent people generally always talk like that. No, you come to church to be maladjusted. You come to church to say, wow, I've never thought about it that way before, or this is different, or I'm harping on Episcopalians, but my friend Lauren Winter is serving an Episcopal church in Durham.
Yeah.
And it's been dwindling for years. Lauren is there and is, well, my wife and I attended there a few Sundays ago, and it was just comfortably filled with young adults, people in their 20s. Well, on the way out, I pull one of them aside and I ask them, you know, hey, you're a Duke undergraduate, you're a 20-something. I would think this would be very strange to you. And the student said, that's why I'm here. Said, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen in my life. And then he said, only something weird can be the truth at the present moment. If something makes sense and all, it's probably not adequate to explain anything. I just thought it was, what a wonderful affirmation of the maladjusting. Just amazing to come together and read from this ancient book that's 2,000 years old, written in languages quite different from our own and a culture different from our own, and to say, okay, North American, arrogant modern people, for just about an hour, we're going to submit to these Jews, and we're going to believe that they know more about God than we do. And let's see where we'll be by noon, okay? Let's just see what'll happen. And I think recovering the strangeness of the church, and by the way, for Episcopalians, you don't have to go that far to look strange.
We are. We're God's peculiar treasure for sure.
You are exuberantly strange. Methodists generally don't have much training in that. So go with that. And I think that kind of maladjustment, people are right to be able to, come to church and say, I expect to hear something that is different than I would hear in the average classroom or at Rotary program. And that's a call for us to enjoy the difference that Christ makes.
We are recording this now as we're heading towards Christmas. We're about halfway through Advent. And we've got our dear friend and brother, John the Baptist, our big cousin, who's calling us snakes and asking us to be sincere and to give our lives away. And so, as we wrap up our time together, I wonder where your mind goes when you think about Advent and obviously into Christmas, specifically given, the last 18, 20 months, this pandemic. All of this rebooting of things, we've lost lives and livelihoods. I wonder where your mind goes as you think about John the Baptist and ultimately the birth of his little cousin Jesus this year.
Well, I thank God for Advent and for again your church kind of introduced that for my church, but in Advent, the church has four Sundays where we try to be honest about the darkness, about the need for light. Advent hymns are all about yearning and not having and desiring. And Advent texts tend to be about God's intervention, that things have gotten where we can't solve what needs to be solved. This weekend, I preached in Toledo, and I was thinking, I don't want to get on the plane, and I want to go there. Well, I got off the plane, and I got into traffic going to the church where I was to preach, and I got behind a pickup truck, and the pickup truck had a big banner on it, and it said, God's Guns and Trump. And I thought, thank you, Lord. You have just given me my motivation for trying to speak the truth, the gospel, this Sunday. We need it. We are a people sitting in darkness. We are a people where people are overcome by fear, by resentment, divisions among people. What better time for the church to say, God's on the way. Help is on the way. God is coming to us. We can't fix what's wrong with us. Good news. God is going to fix it. A virgin is going to conceive and bear a child, Emmanuel. And that's the answer. God has not abandoned us to our fears and our own devices. And I think that's so, what a good time to be in Advent.
Yeah, it is. It is a good time to have something to actually say that is true and that can change, you know, the course of your life. And not everybody has something to say. So we've been given that as a group called the church, this colony of heaven. Bishop Will Willimon, we are so grateful for your time and this fellowship and this opportunity. He's not hawking any books, but I'll tell you, if you haven't read Resident Aliens, get out and get you a copy of that, download that, and his new book called Accidental Preacher. And of course, a book that was really important for me was your reflection on what it was to be a bishop in the Methodist Church. Bishop Will Willimon, we thank you so very much.
Thank you. Wonderful to be with you.
Thank you for listening to Four People with Bishop Rob Wright. We encourage you to subscribe and to share this episode. We will be back with you next week.